It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Joel Salatin has been a guest on Farm to Table Talk more than anyone, and there's a good reason for that. I really like talking to him. People really like listening to him. And I've been thinking about the concerns I'm hearing people that are looking at climate change, looking at the future of our food system, and how new farmers can get started. And it just reminded me, there's so much wisdom that comes from Joel Salatin. I went back and listened to some of the conversations that we've had before, and I found the one I'm going to share with you again today, because I feel just as much as when we had the conversation a couple years ago. It's very relevant today. So here is the person who calls himself the heretic farmer, Joel Salatin.
Thank you, Roger. It's a delight and an honor to be with you always.
Well, you know, Joel, you are so busy already. What compelled you to write another book?
Well, some people would say I have diarrhea of the mouth, but anyway, essentially, it was I write for what I think people need to hear. I don't write for what I think will sell necessarily. I write for what I think people need to hear. And 20 years ago, I wrote what's become my iconic book, You Can Farm, and here we are 20 years after that. And I wanted to do some. You go through life and you have your experiences, and if you're observing, thinking, and tweaking, you develop new things, better messaging, whatever. And so I wanted to take what we've learned in those 20 years. Nothing in You Can Farm is wrong. It's just that we've refined some things. And so I wanted to offer that as a new book out, and it revolves around a speech that I was asked to do in London by Alan Savory, and he wanted me to do a speech on what are the threads of success you see with new farmers, and so it was extremely well received. I've done it many, many, many times. And every time I did, I said, I should put this in the book, because essentially it was the condensation of what I saw people being successful with from a business standpoint. So wrote the book, and it's been extremely well received.
Well, I like this book a lot, and something surprised me about this book. And that is, more than some of your other books I've looked at, I thought it was applicable to people that aren't just farmers.
Yes.
It's you pick it up thinking that you're going to use it just for your farm, and certainly that's probably what an awful lot of people will do in their own farming venture or thinking about getting into farming. But the lessons that you have in there really make you stop and think. I Joel, no kidding. I really like the way you write, and it's easy to sit down with the book and spend an evening with you. It's just like chatting with you. But it really is.
Well,
you pull it off.
Well, thank you. That when people ask me, how do you write? And when I write, I put myself in a persona. I imagine somebody sitting across the desk from me, or the laptop, what I'm writing on, and I put myself in a dialogue mode. I say, what if I were just trying to communicate this concept to somebody sitting here? And I envision a person sitting there, and how would I express this? And so, my style is very conversational. It's not necessarily grammatical. I don't always make, it's not always a complete sentence, from the capitalized first letter to the period at the end. But I want it to be my favorite comment is what you just said. I feel like I know you because I visited with you, through your book. And that, to an author, that's like, You know, that's like nirvana, you know.
Well, I read a lot of books, and I especially feel that way. I'm not kidding you. I'm just sitting there and imagining that we're almost having a cup of coffee together. But tell me, what is the environment when you're writing a book? I mean, do you take your laptop and go sit in an easy chair somewhere, or is there a certain time of day? Or, I mean, what's your props when you start putting yourself into getting it onto a page?
Yeah, well, my props are I make an outline. So that's essentially a rough plan. So that you got your chapter titles, essential basic divisions that you want, topics of discussion, and then I just make kind of bulleted ideas that I want. Okay, this chapter, I want this idea, this, and then so I have that outline with me. That becomes my guide, and when I have, I can write anywhere. Much of this one was written on airplanes. You know, or in airports, you know, when I'm flying, traveling, I can get away from the desk, get away from, you know, the farm here and all the people, the crunch of people through it. And I can, but as long as I have that outline, I can kind of pick up where I left off. And I just crank it out. Now I do, when I'm getting ready to do a writing project, I often develop a file for like a year or two before I actually start writing and start collecting anecdotes, little tidbits, all sorts of little things, and just put them in that file. Then I have that also. I can use some of it. I don't always use all of it. In fact, sometimes I don't use a lot of it. But the point is that I'm putting myself in an intellectual place to wrestle with a topic for a good period of time before I ever do the first word. And once I start writing, it's a pretty short process from start to finish. Normally is not more than a month. I say what I want to do is crank it out, get it out on paper. And once you have it rough, you can always finesse it. You can add stuff, delete stuff. You can always change it, but it's that initial rough copy that if you don't get it done, you lose momentum. And for me, different people are different, I'm sure, but for me, writing a book is all about momentum. And once I'm committed and I type the first word on the laptop, I'm committed. That's it. And now I become momentarily, obsessive compulsive OCB or something.
Yeah.
Obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. I'm not that way, but I am temporarily when I'm writing a book, because I know if I don't stay with it and keep it up and get interrupted, it's very, very hard to come back to the momentum, pick up your pace, pick up your idea and go again.
What kind of a laptop do you work on?
I'm working on a MacBook Pro.
Mm-hmm. And then when you're organizing your files, you got files on like Dropbox, or do you have it on your desktop, or do you use or do you travel with a manila folder or a big old envelope that you stuff ideas in?
I'm a Luddite. It's a manila folder. You know, when I say clip and paste or cut, I mean scissors and rubber glue. I'm an old journalism, newspaper junkie in high school. You know, we were so crude in high school to put together the student newspaper that we would actually, no computers back then. It was not even electric typewriters. And so to justify the right margin, we would type out a line, and if we couldn't get the next word on that, we would put /// until the bell rang.
I've done that.
And then when you did the column like that, then you went back and retyped it, counting the slashes and, you know, double spacing and adding enough spaces in to make it all come out right. I mean, I, Can you imagine we used to do that?
Oh, yeah. No, actually, I kind of miss that. I'm out looking for a manual typewriter myself. I just love that clickety-click sound you used to get with the old manual typewriters when I first took typing. You know, Joel, I've seen you at meetings where you're just flocked. You speak and everybody's circling around you and everything. And I kind of pull back and watch you from a distance, and you really do pay attention to everybody. I mean, I really like that about you, that you're, you know, you let people come up and get you, and they're telling you all about their little bit, their story, and you pay attention to them. One thing I haven't seen is see you pull a notebook out and jot some of those things down, but I know you must be capturing it. Do you find that after a meeting's over, you pull a notebook out or someplace that you're writing notes about the ideas you got or the questions you got?
Yes, I do. Sometimes, I mean, you haven't seen me everywhere, obviously, but so absolutely sometimes I'll grab a piece of paper. Oh, I want to write that down. And I do it right there on the spot. Other times, as soon as I get, you know, by myself, I write it down, or I might ask them, could you put your, you know, contact information, here? And, I don't do that as much as I should now that I'm the editor of Stockman Grass Farmer magazine. I'm trying to be more diligent about all that, but, you know, I'm a storyteller. I remember all this stuff, but I don't always remember names, dates, places, things like that. But when you start actually putting them in a column, it helps to actually, you know, be able to go back, verify, fill in details, and do that a little better. So I try to do that a little better, but absolutely, I often come home with, you know, with idea leads, story leads, article leads, written down, that I have numerous, again, manila folders here at the desk, files of, you know, ideas for Mother Earth news columns, Stockman Grass Farmer editorials, you know, spring newsletter material, Acres USA articles, you know, book ideas. I have a whole file of book ideas. So you want to capture that, you know, that whatever intellectual adrenaline rush, you know, when it happens.
You know, I got to share an idea. I remember a long time ago when I was doing radio sales one time, and went to this dealership. I think he was a John Deere dealership. And I was asking him how he captured ideas, and you know, pretty much it was a folder. I mean, he clipped things and he jotted things down and he stuck them in a folder. But the one thing he did was every year he had a date with himself that he'd take off this folder of ideas and spend a whole day alone with a pot full of coffee and going back over those ideas, kind of distilling them again. I thought that was great. I haven't really practiced that, but just the way you start grabbing these things, and
yes.
I knew you had to have a system because it shows in your book, because you're remembering things and you're bringing stories forward that you clearly have picked up over the years, and
right.
Sharing them with us, we get to live them.
Yeah, I say sometimes I feel like I'm just a little bee, and I'm just a pollinator. You know, I don't have anything new. I just pollinate ideas I've heard over here and bring them over there, and that's just a wonderful thing to do.
You know, and the pollination that you're doing, you're giving people a way of looking at, I think, a way of looking at life, let alone the farming. And like I said, I think it goes beyond just farming, the lessons that you got in your book. Do you remember when you were a little kid, if you saw TV, but when I was a little kid, I saw there's a show called The Dobie Gillis Show. Did you ever hear of it?
No.
Okay. So this Dobie Gillis Show is just a crazy sitcom show. And that's one kind of lazy, what they would call the beatnik then, that was kind of in the neighborhood, named Maynard Krebs. Every time he heard the word work, he just kind of screamed. There was a shock. And he could overhear work someplace, and as soon as he said work, he go work, and you know, react to it. And
it was,
I kind of thought
like,
of
it was like Fonzie, yeah, it was like Fonzie, who could never say I was wrong. He could never say he was wrong.
Yeah, yeah. You know, And so I was going through your book, and I was kind of thinking like I was Maynard Krebs, you know, kind of reacting to work, because I looked at it, and you didn't pull punches, because I think there's a lot of people that admire the idea of having a job that works outside, and you get all of that satisfaction, and then you're in a pleasant day, in a pleasant environment, and you feel good about what you're doing, and you're not commuting, and you're your own boss, and you know, on and on and on, and that's a pretty pleasant picture, and it's something that people all over the country and all over the world dream about. And you've helped some of them kind of get onto that stage. I felt this time, though, you were kind of doing some tough love and saying, okay, fine, but you got to step it up. And all of these things are great, and it's part of what you're doing and why you're doing it, but you might have to go get you shirts at Goodwill, and you might have to put 70 hours in some weeks and things like that. And I just felt like you were stepping it up this time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you're right. I'm an encourager. I'm a cheerleader. I want people to go out there but now, you know, I'm old enough and seen enough people come and go in my lifetime that as I started putting this together and saying, what are the reasons people fail? What's the problem? And you start realizing how many have. I mean, that I personally know. I mean, they were gung-ho for 3 years and flared out. You know, now they're gone. You don't hear from them at all. And there are way more of those than have actually stayed with it for 10 or 12 years. And so I think that a lot of the people that don't persist, that do quit, let's say, I think they have the talent and the ability to be successful, but they came with improper expectations. And so in this book, I'm trying to give not only a recipe for a success, but actually put it in a context of expectation so that everybody will come to it, whatever, expecting reality rather than expecting a fantasy. And it's a lot, your risk of quitting diminishes a lot if you expect it to be hard and expect to work at it and expect to put in long hours, than if you come expecting, oh man, you know, every day is going to be 70 and puffy clouds and blue skies and the chickens are going to be healthy and happy and everything's going to be hunky-dory. And you know what? All my neighbors are suddenly going to want to spend extra for good food and you build it and they will come. That's fantasy talk. That's fantasy world. And we don't do ourselves any favor by actually laying down a foundation of fantasy expectation. Better to lay down a foundation of reality expectation. And then if it's not quite so bad, hey, you know, that's just cream. But at least you know what you're getting into. So
when you talk about that, Joel, to me that sounds like there's a second stage to that journey. I mean, you started this journey and you come to grips with that. You figure it out and you figure out this is what has to happen and this is the way I'm going to have to put this program together. But then you build an organization. I mean, you've got your family involved. You've got maybe 20 some people that are involved in the operation right now. And you've gone way beyond just moving the chickens from one pasture to another to processing and doing things that you probably didn't think you'd have to. So it seems like, Joel, you've had to make that journey personally, but then you have to build an organization that everybody can see where they fit in their own journeys on this. I don't know I don't think I worded that very well, but you know what I'm trying to get at.
I think you did just fine. And I think that almost nobody honestly can draw out a pathway for the future. You make plans, you even make business plans, but you make a business plan for yourself just so you've gone through the process. But you know what? It ain't going to look like that in 10 years. It never does. There's these twists and turns and things that you can't ever imagine. And so what's happened in the last 10 years is we've, come to this almost, iconic status. People think that we've got some special, whatever, unfair thing here. Most people realize that we're not independently wealthy. They know it's not money, but they think there's something here. And I've come to the reality in the last 10 years that what we have is persistence, faithfulness, and just stubbornness to stay with it. I tell them, look, I'm not smarter than anybody. I don't have some special dispensation. No fairy came down and said, well, I'm going to anoint this one. We just had persistence. We stayed with it. We didn't quit. And what I see too often is impatience. Smart people, good people, people with good character, but just a little too impatient, waiting for the for the ship to come in. And mm-hmm. you just need to go to that shore a couple more times to watch for that ship, and it might just show up on the horizon. And it's always darkest before the dawn. I know that's a cliche, but it's true. It is darkest before the dawn. It's at your most incompetent feeling time. That is the moment when the breakthrough is going to happen. When you're going to see, this is what we need to do, or the nice big customer is going to pop through the door. Those sorts of things. I've seen it so many times. For us and other people. And so helping people to understand, here are the principles that we just stayed with. You just stay with this principle. And this is a recipe that will, that will cook you up success over time. It won't happen overnight. It'll happen over time.
Well, with your own team, the people that are all involved with your organization right now, do you recognize them at different stages of their journey? I mean, have you been doing this long enough now that you can spot somebody and you know what they're thinking when they're plucking chickens and thinking, I wish I was Joel and getting to go on a plane and go speak to farmers in Mississippi. Do you see that in your team, seeing them kind of different stages along that road?
Well, sure. And we do a very formal intern program, then apprenticeship program. We have the subcontractor farmers, and we've watched, numerous of these over the years launch as full-time folks and full-time farmers. And absolutely, the weak links in individual farms is different from place to place. Sometimes it's experience. But most of the time it involves something regarding relationships, and expectations, husband, wife, different expectations, children expectations, rapidity, how fast does this happen? Expectations. And so yes, you can absolutely say, okay, you are now ready. You are now ready for a commission-based marketer. You are now ready for a fence post pounder. You see these different things, and there's a definite progression in that, a business progression in that. Yeah.
As you go out and you're talking to groups around the country, and I know you've been outside of the United States too, speaking to groups, I'm curious what's different and what's the same.
What's different? You mean outside? Well, the
US? Yeah. When you go to different places, different regions, yeah. I mean, not everywhere is like the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia.
No.
And so you might be in the desert in Arizona, and you may be in the uplands of England. But I'm wondering what you notice that's maybe different about the different areas you go to and what they're interested in, what they're concerned with, and what's the same everywhere you go.
Sure. That's a great question. I've never just thought of it that way before, but I think what's different is certainly climate is very different. There's a big difference in what you can and can't produce, or the difficulty of producing in a, you know, in a cold or an arid or a warm or a wet, dry, in climate. So, you know, climate is a big, big difference. A second difference is population density. There's a big difference between living within an hour of, you know, 200,000 people and living within an hour of a Coke machine. When I do marketing seminars in Idaho and Wyoming and Nevada, you know, South Dakota, North Dakota, you know, Montana, you know, if you're an hour away from a Coke machine, it's going to be a different ball game than if you're an hour away from 200,000 people. So population density is a big one. Another one is regulatory differences between Europe, Australia, New Zealand. Here, you know, the differences between the European Union and, for example, the developing countries, Latin America, Africa, where there are basically, you know, no regulations. I just talked with a fellow yesterday from, he's got a little farm, a 10-acre farm in Guatemala. And there's basically no regulations. I mean, he can have goat milk, make cheese, sell milk, butcher chickens, you know, make whatever, you know, pot pie, quiche. There's no regulation whatsoever. And so the regulatory climate in different situations is a big difference. And then I would say another big difference is just access to capital. I did a 2-day seminar in Bulgaria 2 months ago, and you know, it's the poorest of the kind of, you know, old Soviet pieces, states, countries, and it just, the whole country just looks tired. It's resource rich. I mean, it has wonderful resources. The people are wonderful. But it just, there's no money. There's no money. There's no capital. So of course, since it joined the EU, the young people are all, you know, they can drive 6 hours and double their income if they go to Greece or Austria, you know, just go right outside the country of Bulgaria. And so farmers there that I talked with that are trying to do this, and I talked to one who's actually pretty far along. He's got, you know, pastured pigs and chickens and, you know, direct marketing and doing a lot of cool stuff. The difference in his ability to attract young labor is just horrendous. And we spent a lot of time, you know, dealing with that issue because the young people, the whole country, the young people are just gone. You know, the U.S., I mean, certainly people leave our country, but it's still a place of opportunity, and young people want to be here. Young people like to be here. And so, you know, it's one thing to attract young people to farming. It's another thing to have any young people at all to even attract to anything. So, you know, those just labor and capital things are different. What's the same is, what is the same is everywhere people are becoming more mistrustful of government and the official party line, what I call, you know, the orthodoxy. People are becoming more and more mistrustful of that. They don't trust big business. They don't trust big government. They don't trust the orthodoxy. And we're seeing the, you know, I mean, Brexit obviously is an example of that. Well, the Trump thing, that's an example of that, is this mistrust. And that whole mistrust is driving people to look for authenticity. Authenticity is kind of the, you know, the flip side of mistrust. And so everywhere in the world that I've been, there's huge interest in authentic food, local food, knowing farmer, food with a face. I mean, all these things, that is the same. That is totally ubiquitous in the, on the planet right now. And that's a wonderful place to be for people who are in the authentic space. It's very cool.
Well, the example you show them is very livestock oriented. I mean, your program is making the best of improving the soil and working with livestock in your operation. But why do you think your message translates to the people that don't have a chance at livestock? Say, for example, the people that, you know, they're urban farmers now. And I've been in audiences where maybe there are 300 people in the audience and probably only 30 of them are actually going to become farmers, but everyone was enjoying your message. I mean, does that ever surprise you how well it translates to people that probably don't have an opportunity to have chickens and cows?
No, it doesn't surprise me. It's, I still pinch myself sometimes, to realize what a, you know, what a broad tent this is. Cause the truth is you can, we have naked collies, you know, you can go without clothes. You know, you can live under a bridge and be homeless, not very happy, but you know, you can be homeless, but you know, you can't go without food. Food is so basic to existence that it becomes the broadest tent. And so when you start talking about food and you start talking about how to produce that food, what kind of food, who's going to produce that food, all the things regarding food, which of course farming is foundational to that discussion. It is indeed, you know, the broadest tent. And so, my message often revolves, I always see farming as a subset of the food system. You know, a lot of food we have today doesn't need a farm. Or very little of a farm. It's manufactured stuff, you know, and so trying to realize that I'm ultimately talking about food. Yes, lots of times I talk about farming, and farming's a big part of that. And I'd like food to come from farms. Realizing that my message is primarily a food-centric message. That makes it both interesting, applicable, and inspiring to people who, you know, will never actually have a farm.
Now, you said that well. I think this is a good time to mention to people where they can look online to find more of your connections and see the other books. What's your website, Joel?
Our website is Polyface Farms. That's Polyface. Polyface Farms. Poly, of course, means many. It's the prefix for many. So it's the many-faced farm, Polyface Farms. And yes, our website has my speaking schedule, books, YouTube videos, you know, lots of stuff there. And I invite, you know, people to slip there and take a look.
And your latest book, Your Successful Farm Business, that company that owns Whole Foods has it online too. So I can't remember their name right now, but if people,
yeah, they're kind of small.
Yeah.
Kind of small.
So you can find it. Well, hey, you know, just wrapping up, Joel, you have to keep yourself charged up. When you look down the road, what makes you the most enthusiastic and optimistic about the near-term future?
Well, nothing charges me up like seeing the land heal. That's still kind of our core soul. We love what our touch, our participation, our caress, if you will, on the land does to transform it into abundance and beauty. And so that still is what floats my boat. And just this morning I spent a couple of hours brainstorming with a couple of fellows that want to, we lease a piece of property. We've been there for 10 years. We watched it transform to just, you know, a beautiful place. And the family that's inherited it now, we rented it from the mom and dad. They've both died in the 10 years. Now the kids have it. They want to sell it. And so this morning I met with, you know, some folks that are, you know, talking about how do we, You know, can we form an investment group to buy the land and hold it together? And you know, there's a neighbor winery. Can we, you know, join forces and have something here? And so, you know, that kind of stuff still, man, I get so energized over dreaming about how to keep land from turning into strip malls, how to, you know, keep the earthworms happy, grow the soil and make, you know, make landscape pastoral beauty. That's still what floats my boat and what I find, you know, exciting for the future and to know that, yep, you know, there's probably, as I'm watching farmers in the community die and their kids sell, I'm realizing, good night, you know, there's going to be land available here to be loved, you know, for a long, long time. And so I just want to be, you know, faithful with what we have, not grasp it, not, you know, not be dissatisfied if we don't get something else, but to be asked by them or a new owner or somebody, will you come and touch my land? Man, that's better than blessing babies.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that floats my boat is every once in a while getting a chance to have a conversation with Joel Salatin and share that conversation with people that are listening now all over the world to Farm to Table Talk. And Joel, thanks for being our podcast conversation this morning.
Thank you for having me. It is an honor and a true delight. Yes.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.